Thanks for setting the record straight on breadboxmedia.com. Today I'm going to continue the series on Islam and the Muslim occupation for over seven centuries, of the Iberian Peninsula, Spain, France, and Portugal today. There's something called the Black Legend that is a slander on the Catholic Church and on the Spanish Catholic Church. It was largely invented over the centuries that Britain was at war with Spain, and it's nothing but war propaganda, but unfortunately is taught today, and even believed by Tony Blair, the recent convert to Catholicism, after he was allowed to convert, because he was no longer prime minister, because they have in Great Britain still a law against prime ministers being Catholics. Tony Blair said the standard bearers of tolerance in the early Middle Ages were far more likely to be found in Muslim lands than in Christian ones, Catholic ones. That was from an article in Foreign Affairs, January 2007. This couldn't be more wrong. Our British friends didn't have their guard up. They let their guard down, believing the wrong thing. They're learning a hard lesson today. It's the Black Legend. In Britain now, London has become Londistan. And the Islamics today are probably somewhat more tolerant than they were back then. And the purpose of this series of programs is to demystify Islamic Spain by questioning the widespread belief that it was a wonderful place of tolerance and what was called conviviencia, of three cultures under the benevolent supervision of enlightened Muslim rulers. I'm going to occasionally quote throughout this series this 19th century romantic vision of Islamic Spain in the mouths of modern leaders of our world, academics of great respect. They're parroting the false history that the previous generations have handed to them. We go back to primary sources, or indeed to Spanish sources, and we'll find out the truth. This 19th century romantic vision of Islamic Spain has morphed today into the mainstream academic and popular writings that celebrate Al-Andalus for its, quote, multiculturalism, unity of Muslims, Catholics, and Jews, diversity, pluralism. All of these words are used. Regardless of how close such emphasis is to the facts, some scholars of the Spanish Middle Ages have even openly declared an interest in promoting these ideas. The record has to be set straight. We've got to bust the myth. This civilization requires focusing, busting a myth about this paradise, this false civilization, requires focusing a searching light on medieval cultural features that may seem less than savory to many of our listeners, and perhaps for that reason are seldom discussed. I want to repeat something I said earlier. Probably the worst offender among academics is a man named David Levering Lewis. He's a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner and a great defender of Marxist intellectuals. He wrote a book, God's Crucible and the Making of Europe, 570 to 1215, published by Norton, 2008. He's very honored. And from his book, I want to quote one long sentence that couldn't be less correct. In the Middle Ages, there emerged two Europes. One was Muslim, secure in its defenses, religiously tolerant, and maturing in cultural and scientific sophistication. The other, Catholic Europe, an arena of unceasing warfare, in which superstition passed for religion, and the flame of knowledge sputtered weakly. One has to love assured effrontery, talking about maturing in cultural and scientific sophistication. When the scientific method was invented in Catholic Europe, a Catholic Europe that believes in a reasonable God, as Pope Benedict pointed out, the achievements cultural and scientific of Catholic Europe tower over the few rudimentary contributions made in Al-Andalus during those seven centuries. And very often when we really examine the architecture, the buildings, the architecture, that seems so derivative of European style, but with a difference, a touch of difference, have really been designed by European architects. So much of what we think of as the Islamic culture, as the pinnacles of Islamic culture, actually come from people that are descended of Europeans, or Europeans who are forced to work, or forced to do this work. Let's give one more source. The British sources are the best. Boy, have they let them. We can observe today that this excessive tolerance and non-factually based tolerance on Muslims has resulted in them being overrun by it. Now, London is now called Londonistan, a little bit humorously, but actually with reality, now that the mayor of London, the elected mayor of London, is a radical Muslim. So from the Oxford Encyclopedia, The Modern Islamic World, this is 2009, Oxford University Press. This is pretty austere, tower of academia. I want to point out that Oxford was Catholic longer in its long life than it Anglican. It's one of the great cultural treasures stolen from the Catholic Church. On an intellectual level, Islam played an important role in the development of Western European civilization by passing on both the philosophy of Aristotle and its own scientific, technological, and philosophical tradition. Religious tolerance remained a part of Islamic law, although its application varied with social, political, and economic circumstance. So many mistakes in that paragraph that setting the record straight is like untying a Gordian knot. It's been theorized that the 18th century enlightenment of the critical construction, actually, since the 18th century enlightenment, the critical construction, and it's invented out of whole cloth, of a diverse, tolerant, and happy Islamic Spain has been part of an effort to sell a particular cultural agenda, which would have been undermined by the recognition of a multicultural society racked by ethnic, religious, social, and political conflicts that eventually contributed to its demise. It was a multicultural society held together only by the ruthless powers of autocrats and clerics. This ideological mission would then be the ultimate reason for the tilting of the narrative against Catholic Spain. That narrative is the Black Legend, and it has been prevalent since the Enlightenment. You can see it in the writings of Voltaire and Edward Gibbon in Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Briskly selling, beautiful illustrated books have contributed to this intellectual construction. In the past few decades, this ideological mission of falsity and of slander against the Catholic Church has morphed into a presentism. Presentism, that's an academically sponsored effort to narrate the past in terms of the present, thereby reinterpret it to serve contemporary multicultural diversity and peace studies, which necessitate rejecting as retrograde, chauvinistic, or worse, conservative any view of the past they may conflict with a progressive agenda. Thus, it is stupendous, quite stupendous, to see how some academic specialists turn and twist to downplay religion as the motivating force in Muslim conquest, and even to question the invasion of Spain by the Muslim Arab-led Berbers as the conquest of one culture and its religion by another culture and its religion. Failing to take seriously the religious factor in Islamic conquests is characteristic of a certain type of materialist secular Western historiography, which finds it uncomfortable to accept that war and the willingness to kill and die in it can be the result of someone's religious faith. An obstacle to understanding that may reflect the role played by religious faith in the lives of many academic historians. What role is played in their lives? Almost nothing. Almost none at all. They have a materialist approach, and this approach has generally prevailed in scholarly analysis of the Crusades, the Spanish Inquisition. But there are many Spanish historians who tell the truth about what went on in those 7 centuries. Nonetheless, rhapsodic accounts predominate. The truth is, the medieval Islamic culture remained, with the exception of science, construction techniques, and some aspects of philosophy, generally unreceptive to the intellectual and cultural spirit of Greek civilization. And it's often said that it's a descendant of it. Among other things, it was indifferent or antagonistic to such fundamentals of that civilization as representational sculpture, painting, drama, narrative, lyric, and political theory and practice. Even in philosophy, Islam remained in part a stranger to the Greek spirit. We need to be reminded, the record needs to be set straight, that Greek texts had not been lost, which is commonly believed, to be graciously, quote, discovered, and, quote, transmitted by the Islamic Empire. but in fact had been preserved, transmitted, and commented upon in the Catholic Greek Roman Empire, in Constantinople, the Byzantine Empire. The translations of Greek scientific and philosophical texts into Arabic were done by Catholics, Greek-speaking Catholics, from the conquered lands of the Catholic Greek Roman Empire. That Aristotle had been translated in France at the Abbey of Mont-Saint-Michel before translations of Aristotle into Arabic. It surfaced in Islamic Spain, and that there was a continuity between Greek and European civilization by the root of the Catholic Greek Roman Empire. That did not require Islam's appearance on the historical scene, as is often asserted by the most distinguished historians in our English-speaking cultures. Of course, this is breadboxmedia.com. You're on the website, you knew that. I'm Chuck Coughlin, this is Setting Records Straight. By the way, my good friend, have you checked out Bless the Yes on the breadboxmedia.com website? Click on Bless the Yes.
Breadbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
On Breadbox Media, this is Chuck Coughlin. We're back after the break. And today we're considering the Muslim occupation of Spain, France, and Portugal for over seven centuries. It was called Al-Andalus. In previous programs, I've talked about the limitations on activities of Catholics in Al-Andalus, which the area was called under the Muslims. Catholics could not exercise political sovereignty in any form. This went down to things of moderate importance to things seemingly of little importance. Catholics could not carry weapons. Catholics must not ride horses in Muslim areas. This is quite a prohibition. It is repeated by the Muslim Turks during their occupation of Greece, when the Greek Orthodox flock could not ride horses, only donkeys, and had to ride sideways like women so they could readily dismount and genuflect before Muslims. The scholar Iman Malik, agreeing with the second caliphate, Umar, observed, "I think the Catholics should be compelled to wear belts. That used to be required of them in old days. I think they should be compelled to be humble." Umar wrote that they should be mounted sideways like women on donkeys. During a certain period of Umayyad rule in Spain, Muslim authorities even declared the forced circumcision of male Christians. In these ways of oppression, intentionally humiliating the dhimmis, the dhimmi is D-H-I-M-M-I, is a term for the second and third class citizens, the non-Muslims, the Jews, and the Catholics. Adding to these ways of oppressing and absolutely intentionally humiliating the dhimmi population, one must add the taxes that Muslim rulers could at any time arbitrarily pile up on top of the jizya, that's the tax, prompted by the rulers' perennial need for cash to maintain their ostentatious lifestyle. Poets, intellectuals, slaves, palaces, harems, and city embellishment programs. Even Spanish Arabs sympathetic to Islamic Spain recognize the harsh measures listed by jurist Ibn Adun in the 11th and 12th century Seville, agreed with the teachings of the medieval Maliki jurisprudence regarding the proper way to keep the dhimmis in, quote, a condition of humiliation and subservience, sigar, or tolerated discrimination. In short, contrary to what is commonly believed, the institution of the dhimmi in Islamic Spain did not generously grant religious autonomy to Catholics. Now, this is a common myth, and it's very widespread in academia today, that Catholics and Jews were treated as equals or had some tolerance or freedom. But that's quite untrue. And I've quoted in the other programs politicians and authors of our day who seem to believe the myth of the tolerant and beneficent Muslim rule in those 7 centuries. It was far from that. Actually, Jewish and Catholic religious practices were limited by the Muslims in numerous ways, and it left their subject Catholics without any possibility of attaining political power. Eventually reduced to minority status, Catholic dhimmis saw their numbers slowly decline as a result of conversions that promised an escape from Islamic laws, humbling limitations, and special taxations, and also as a result of Islamic laws that, for example, forced the children of a Muslim man and a Christian woman to be raised as Muslims, and allowed a Muslim man to have children with up to 4 wives and as many sexual slaves as he could afford to keep. So the situations of Catholics under Muslim rule in Spain was similar to the, quote, benign conditions of the Greek Orthodox Raya under the Turkish Muslims rule, in the words of the historians John Koliopoulos. Greek Orthodox Christians, quote, were tolerated as long as they accepted their inferior status and were prepared to obey the ruler who had imposed that inferior status upon them. The much-praised tolerance of Al-Andalus was thus part of Islam's imperialist system of separation from and subordination of Catholics. Catholics could practice their religion, but only on Islam's terms. Islamic clerics and rulers remained effectively in control in matters of religion, and because religion informed everything, they remained effectively in control of everything. The system of protection, so-called. Then in reality was a system of exploitation. In reality it was a system of subjugation. All the onerous details of everyday practical differentiation and subordination followed from and reinforced the general assumption of Islam's religious and therefore political hegemony. As I have noted before, a factor too little realized about Islam in our country today is that it is not just a religion for which tolerance should be offered, as we would do so for any religion. It is actually a political system. Islam is a political system that contains a religion. And that political system of Sharia law is quite contrary to the principles that can be discovered in our Constitution and our Declaration of Independence. So the process of demanding submission from Jews and Catholics was done quite methodically, right after conquest, right after Islam defeated additional areas in the Andalusian Peninsula. Cut all that. Medieval Islamic conquest quite methodically began this process of submission after Muslim forces had invaded a place, overcome the locals militarily, and chosen a capital. They would pause in their forward advance and begin the process of subjugating the defeated. All the various forms of differentiation and superiority, including a proliferation of mosques and the limitations on church and Christians and Catholic public worship, fostered conversion and Islamization. They could do this without any need to resort to forced conversion, while at the same time reinforcing the conqueror's power. So it was done politically, by tremendous political suppression and tremendous and a slowly tightening noose of political subjugation. Islamic colonization had another ally in the compelling need to use Arabic as a language. Arabic was the language of the Muslim sacred texts and accompanying rituals. Converts, therefore, must learn Arabic, which reinforced their culturization. But Arabs also gradually supplanted the language of the conquered dhimmis, who remained Catholics, because those dhimmis found it necessary to speak, read, and write Arabic in their social, commercial, and political transactions. In fact, to make their own lives easier in a Muslim-dominated society, Catholic dhimmis adopted Arabic-sounding names and even dressed like Muslims when they were allowed to. The Muslim conquerors also adopted the common colonialist tactic of renaming villages, towns, cities, and geographical landmarks, giving them new Arabic-sounding names. In Spain, they even changed the name of the land, España. They changed to Al-Andalus, a word that probably is a garbling of the Greek word for Atlantis Island. Consequently, the history of Islamic conquest shows a rapid decline in the languages of the subject population. After the conquest, this is the 16th century, a Muslim who had converted to Christianity, they called those Moriscos, boasted this: Egyptians, Syrians, Maltese, and other Catholic people speak and write in Arabic. In the Middle East, pre-Islamic languages, with the exception of Farsi, effectively vanished. In North Africa, Berber languages and cultures were quickly marginalized. In Islamic Spain, Jews spoke and wrote Arabic in preference to Hebrew. Over time, Catholic dhimmis, despite their efforts to maintain their culture, became Arabicized, adopting the Arab language and, when allowed, Arab clothes. An even more effective hegemonic strategy consists of transferring the most significant cultural materials of the conquered, that is, their houses of worship, transforming them into mosques. Turning Catholic churches into mosques was a standard demoralizing and hegemonic feature of Muslim conquests. The strategy had been used in the 7th and 8th century in North Africa and in the Middle East, lands that for centuries that had been largely Catholic under the rule of the Greek-Roman Empire. The Greek-Roman Empire we call Byzantium, Constantinople. Since Islam would not allow any Catholic temple or church to tower over a mosque, the magnificent Greek basilicas in these Catholic cities of the Middle East and North Africa were turned into mosques. The best example is the Grand Mosque of Damascus, built on the site of the Greek Basilica of St. John the Baptist, which was demolished and cannibalized for its materials in the early 8th century. As it happened, the splendidly constructed Damascus Mosque, built and decorated by workers and architects from the Catholic Greek-Roman Empire, even its minarets, according to the Persian geographers, were originally watchtowers in the Greek Basilica of St. John the Baptist. All these influences account for the Byzantine look of the mosque. The cultures from which Islamist derives really were nomads and didn't have the concept of cities and large buildings. Many of the architects and workers who built the mosques were actually of Eastern and Western Europe origin. Greek architects also built the mosque of the Caliph Umar in Jerusalem, called the Al-Aqsa Mosque. That was in 1688, and the earlier mosques of Amran in Cairo. Those were built by Greek architects and workers. In the early centuries of Islam, Muslim rulers endeavored to copy in their mosque the exterior architectural features of Catholic churches, but they had the explicit purpose of dwarfing.
This is Chuck Coughlin on BreadboxMedia.com, setting the record straight.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
This is Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight on BreadboxMedia.com. We're back after the break, and we're talking about what the conquests by Muslims meant for the European Catholics in the Iberian Peninsula.
If a Catholic city offered armed resistance, the conversion of Catholic temples or churches into mosques occurred soon after the conquest of the city. A 9th century Muslim historian records that during the conquest of Egypt, the Islamic forces immediately turned a Coptic church into a mosque in the city where the Greek troops had resisted. Shortly after Muslim forces disembarked in Spain, they occupied the ancient city of Cartia, a Visigoth stronghold, a Catholic Visigoth stronghold, and demolished its church. On that spot, they built their first mosque. Under Islamic occupation, Cartia disappeared from history. The Muslim conquerors carried out the same strategy throughout Spain. This domination strategy is best illustrated by the Umayyad Mosque in Cordoba, which since the 13th century has been the Cathedral of Cordoba. As we have seen, this celebrated mosque was built in the 8th century after the Umayyad Emir Abd al-Rahman I destroyed the ancient church of St. Vincent, the main basilica of Cordoba. Left without a church, the Catholics were allowed to build a smaller one, but only outside the city walls. Recent investigations by archaeologists confirm that the Mosque of Cordoba was constructed with columns, capital, and other superior materials cannibalized from Christian and Roman buildings, including St. Vincent. Well, that process didn't stop with that ruler. We'll be mentioning him a lot, Abd al-Rahman I. This is the fact. Whenever Muslim chronicles make reference to Catholic churches in Spain, it is to boast of their transformation into mosques or their outright destruction as symbols of Islamic dominance over the polytheists, as Catholics were called, because they prayed and genuflected in front of the icons and statues of the Virgin Mary, Jesus Christ, the saints and the angels, as well as the cross, the crucifix. So churches were destroyed as part of the persecution of Catholics. Under the Umayyad ruler Muhammad I, this was in the late 800s. In the late 10th century, a ruler, Al-Mansur, was a notorious burner of Christian churches during his military campaigns, and his additions to the Mosque of Cordoba, we learned from a historian, was, quote, built with the materials of demolished churches brought to Cordoba on the hands of Catholic captives. As late as 1195, Muslims on the offensive were still turning Catholic churches of conquered Spain into mosques as a sign of Catholic defeat and submission. Muslim historians emphasize that, like the Jiz attacks, the destruction of Catholic churches, statues, and relics was intended to humiliate the people of the book, that's us, and affirm Islamic hegemony. The book is the Bible.
The surviving Catholics
might be allowed to repair their crumbling church buildings, but only when it suited the Muslim rulers. As a result, granting the humbling dhimmis permission to repair their temples and churches was equally effective at reminding Catholics that they remained always at the mercy of their conquerors. There was a group of holy men, Muslim men, they called the Tabi'un, T-A-B-I-U-N, Tabi'un.
Now this group enjoyed great prestige. They had been trained under the first generation of the companions of the Prophet Muhammad.
A lot of Muslim historians describe that the Tabi'un accompanied the Islamic armies that conquered Spain. Their purpose was to oversee the Islamization of the land. They were in charge of supervising the religious aspect of every Islamic conquest, such as the founding of mosques and their proper orientation, as well as the distribution of booty and lands according to Islamic principles. These men, only a couple of generations removed from Muhammad and his personal teachings, would have overseen the early process by which Islam displaced Catholic culture from power in Spain. The false myth about what was going on there populates the internet. There's a high-traffic website, homeearthlink.net, and they have an entry called A Brief History of Al-Andalus. I'll quote from that. It says, both Christians and Jews, who were people of the book, both Jews and Christians, they should have said Catholics, who were people of the book, were treated well, aside from taxes, and allowed to worship freely with a few restrictions. The Christians were not to ring their church bells. Muslims, Christians, and Jews all dressed similarly, and the Muslims often attended Christian celebrations. These Christians, who lived in many ways like the Arabs, were known as Mozarabs, from the Arabic word meaning Arabizer. Of course, we're talking about Catholics. There were no Protestants. The truth is that after a Muslim victory over infidels, whether the defeated Catholics were allowed to live or they were executed, was entirely up to the Muslim leader. I'll give you one incident. An officer of Abba Rahman III beheaded 100 Catholic prisoners in Cordoba in full view of the Muslims exiting the mosque after the Friday prayer. Here's a quote from that history. All the prisoners one by one are beheaded. In plain sight of the people's feelings against the infidel, Allah alleviated, and then showered their blessings on the caliph. Unquote. So there was no more a culture of tolerance in what remained of the Catholic community in Islamic Spain than there was in the Muslim or Jewish communities. Like the Sephardic Jewish community, the Catholic demis ruled themselves through exclusionary laws motivated by a fear of the others. Those laws endured from the time of the Visigoth rule in Spain. There was a king who converted to Catholicism. That was made official when he convened a great third church council in Toledo, 589. Visigoth laws added provisions against the only heresy known in the kingdom before the Muslim invasion, Arianism, the teaching of the Christian presbyter Arius. The Visigoth law prohibited use of the Arian creed in churches. It forbade Arians from occupying public office. Let's quote from another academic. This is in the Edinburgh Companion to the Arab novel in English, The Politics of Anglo-Arab and Arab-American Literature and Culture, published by Edinburgh University Press, 2013. It said this: during Abd al-Rahman III's reign, there emerged a brand of Islamic culture open to multiple currents of influence and integrating and nourishing them under what might be called, following Marshall Hodgson, an Islamicate culture. The truth is that Catholic dhimmis who fled to the northern kingdoms of Catholics frequently encountered the same Visigoth law by which they ruled themselves under Islam. And this Visigoth law continued to inform Spanish law for centuries. In the northern Catholic kingdoms, these former dhimmis, these immigrants, built churches and monasteries and brought with them valuable books from former Visigoth Spain. Some of these books may have served as models for several jewels of medieval art. I'm talking about the extraordinary illuminations that accompany biblical commentaries. They were written in Latin, but in Visigoth script. The monks that did that were Beato de Labagna and Beato of San Miguel de Escalada. As a scholar of Islam and Catholic Christianity, these Mozarabs, as these immigrants were called, preserved the tradition of Visigoth spirituality and were influenced by the culture of northern Catholics, and they added to the earlier cultural contributions of other Visigoths from Spain who had fled the initial Muslim invasion and made their way to northern Spain and Europe. They may well have influenced the great art of the Spanish Romanesque. After the Muslim occupation in the 8th century, it took many years for Catholic Spain to develop the greatness of its own medieval Catholic culture, and its rich lyric and narrative poetry, and its powerful Romanesque and Gothic architecture and sculpture. The process continued through the Renaissance and the Catholic Counter-Reformation, and culminated in the Spanish Golden Age, with such literary figures as Garcilaso de la Vega, St. John of the Cross, St. Teresa of Avila, Fray Luis de León, Miguel de Cervantes, Lope de Vega, Tirso de Molina, Francisco de Quevedo, and Calderón de la Barca. Such a pioneer of international law is the Dominican priest Francisco del Vitoria. Such thinkers on liberty and conquest as the Dominican bishop, a favorite of mine, Bartolomeo de las Casas. Such economic, political, and philosophical thinkers as the Dominican priest Domingo de Soto and others. And the Jesuit priest Luis de Molina and Francisco Suarez. And a whole list of composers. And such formidable painters as Velazquez, Diego Velázquez. And the man, you know, as El Greco, the Greek, he was Greek. His name was Dominikos Theotokopoulos. This man, El Greco, is an artist from the Catholic Greek diaspora, which had barely survived the centuries-long but relentless destruction of their civilization by the iconoclastic Islamic warriors of the Middle East. It had happened there too, in Greece. For setting the record straight just a little bit, it's a huge record. It's an awful lot to set straight. An hour didn't do it. 6 hours didn't do it. This has been a multi-part series of Setting the Record Straight. Thank you so much. Chuck Coughlin on breadboxmedia.com. This is just a break. We'll be right back.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Chuck Coughlin, I'm back with you. Setting the record straight about the Black Legend, which resulted from the competition between Britain and Spain. This centuries-long war, this competition, produced a lot of war propaganda. I think you'll agree that that's a normal human activity, a normal human trait. And since we live in an English-speaking culture, former British colonies, we've adopted a lot of that war propaganda from centuries past as if it were true. So we have a false idea about the Crusades, especially about the Spanish Inquisition. And one of the things that has been painted as this romantic paradise is Al-Andalusia. When Islamic caliphs ruled all of Spain, France, most of France, and Portugal, the Iberian Peninsula. And everywhere you look, among the academics of today, and among the politicians today, I've just cited earlier in this series, Tony Blair's comments on this, which are very misinformed. Basically, there's anti-Catholicism that lies behind it. And I am aware that Tony Blair is a recent convert to Catholicism. But he was educated in British schools. Let me give you a sample of academic opinion on this subject. For instance, Hugh Kennedy, professor of history in the Department of Languages and Culture of the Near Middle East of the University of London. He wrote a book, Muslim Spain and Portugal, A Political History of Al-Andalus. London, Routledge, 1996. Quote, the historical importance of the killing of the martyrs of Cordoba is difficult to determine and probably tells us little about the condition and attitudes of the bulk of the Mozarab population, though the incident does show the tolerance and essential reasonableness of the Muslim authorities. But it raises interesting moral and theological points about self-inflicted martyrdom, unquote. I have to admit I'm sort of amused by the black humor of that. Aren't all martyrdoms self-inflicted? And to depict them as so is to trivialize the great sacrifice that these people made for their Catholic faith. Well, the most extraordinary instance of Catholic demi-resistance was the episode of the martyrs of Cordoba. And why should they not resist? We've just talked about the conditions that they lived under. Between 850 and 860, under the reign of Ubayyad ruler Ar-Rahman II, men and women, some of them belonging to Catholic families who had converted to Islam, called Muladis, defied the authorities by publicly affirming their Catholic faith and by ridiculing Muhammad. The story has come down to us in the writings of the last of the martyrs, the monk Saint Eulogius, and in the writings of his friend Alvarez, a monk who actually lived through the events. The first one to die as a martyr was a well-educated monk named Perfectus. In 850, having traveled from his nearby monastery to the city of Cordoba on some errand or other, this Catholic dhimmi encountered some Muslims he knew who asked him to explain what Catholics thought of Christ and the Prophet Muhammad. He told them that they might not like the answer. but they insisted. Perfectus made them promise not to tell his answer to anyone. He proceeded to cite a passage from the Gospel, in which Christ declares that, quote, many false prophets will come in my name, unquote. And Perfectus added that the Catholics believe that Muhammad to be one of those false prophets. Perfectus then went on his way. Some days later, the same Muslims saw him in the city, pointed him out to the crowds, and accused him of having insulted the prophet. So Perfectus was arrested and locked in prison. Although during the interrogation he denied having said any insulting words, the outline of this case to this point corresponds to the pattern of cases of Catholics punished for alleged blasphemy in Islamic countries today. This is the same pattern that these Catholic martyrs, Christian martyrs that are being beheaded them at least, this is what happens to them. They make fairly reasonable, historically accurate comments, and later on they pay a terrible price. While in prison, however, the monk Perfectus recanted his earlier denial. He openly proclaimed Christ's divinity and the imposture of Muhammad. Perfectus, of course, was publicly beheaded. According to the extant accounts of the monk Alvarez, a year later, a Catholic demon named Juan was denounced by some Muslim merchants for trying to increase his sales by swearing on Muhammad. Alvarez tells us that Muslims used to laugh at Catholicism and insult Catholics, and that Muslim envy was a reason to accuse Juan. When several Muslims testified against Juan, he, the Dhimmi, was found guilty, publicly lashed, paraded through the city, and sent to prison. But the decisive event seems to have been a case which involved a man named Isaac. At 24 years of age, this Catholic Dhimmi abandoned a lucrative position in the city of Cordoba to enter the monastic life. 3 years later, in 851, he made the momentous decision to go to Cordoba and in front of the judge declare Muhammad a false prophet and Islam a false religion, knowing that he would be executed for these blasphemies. He was publicly beheaded, and his cadaver was hung upside down at one of the Cordoba city gates. One could say this was a self-inflicted martyrdom in this case, but it was martyrdom nonetheless. It was intolerance nonetheless. How do we treat someone who denies the divinity of Christ? Do we behead them and hang their body upside down at city gate? Some paradise of tolerance. All these events had an effect on the number of Dhimmis and Mulattis who adopted what today would be called a policy of nonviolent resistance. Oh, here it comes very early, does it not? It was nonviolent resistance against the dominant culture. They defied the Muslim blasphemy laws by publicly proclaiming the divinity of Christ and the falsehood of Muhammad as a prophet, and they refused to recant. Nearly 50 men and women were publicly executed, the martyrs of Cordoba. Some beheaded, some boiled to death. Their cadavers were hung upside down at the city gates to deter future martyrs. But these exhibits appeared to stimulate rather than deter Catholic Dhimmis and the crypto-Catholic Mulattis. In other words, those that had converted to Islam, while in their hearts they were still Catholic. They'd done it for survival. So that's a crypto-Catholic Mulatti. Each day, new Christians volunteered for martyrdom. The Muslim authorities then turned to a different procedure. Instead of exhibiting the cadavers of the Catholics, they burned them and threw their ashes in the river. A number of these martyrs were Mulattis who openly renounced their Islamic faith or proclaimed that they had been crypto-Catholics. In response to this Christian martyrdom, Abul Rahman II, following the advice of the ulama, imprisoned Catholic priests, confiscated Catholics' property, and instituted a series of measures to make it more difficult for all Catholics. These measures were similar to the drastic actions the invading Muslims had taken to subjugate stubborn Catholics. This was well documented in the Chronicle of the Mozarabs, a work of 754. There were a lot of other Catholic and Muslim sources from the time, primary sources. then threatening escalated measures against the Christian dhimmis. Abba Rahman pressured Catholic bishops to convene a church council in Cordoba to address the growing problem of Catholic martyrdom. Under this pressure, the Council of Bishops ordered Catholics not to follow the martyr's example. Eventually, this voluntary martyrdom, but aren't all martyrdoms voluntary? Eventually, this voluntary martyrdom stopped. With their public displays of Catholic faith and their open affirmation that Muhammad was not a prophet and Jesus Christ was the Son of God, both of these are blasphemies in Muslim eyes, the martyrs of Cordoba led a metaphorical assault against the dominant Islamic religion and culture, which is, of course, the same thing. They're a theocracy. Islam is a political system that encompasses within it an organic part of it, the Islamic religion. This public defiance released years of pent-up Catholic anger and frustration at religious, social, and political subjugation. It also represented a desperate and ultimately ineffective effort to stem the growing tide of Islamic acculturation that was eroding Catholic culture in Spain. But scholars of our day, politically correct scholars, do not usually describe the Catholic defiance in the above terms as understandable and courageous instances of nonviolent resistance, brave nonviolent resistance, by members of the disempowered and marginalized group. As our politically correct academics would probably characterize similar acts by any subject group except Catholics or Christians. As far back as Reinhard Dozy in the 19th century and Emmanuel Levy Provençal in the early 20th century and continuing to the present, scholars have typically described the actions of the martyrs of Cordoba as the foolish decisions of religious fanatics, stubborn and ignorant monks, and their unthinking followers, all in the thrall of superstitions. In one representative statement, a scholar called the Catholic dhimmi resistance the work of, quote, an intransigent minority, not at all willing to live in peaceful convivienza and respect toward Islam. This subject cries out for having its record set straight by somebody. The views of these modern scholars were already present among the collaborationist church authorities in Cordoba. The testimonies of the monks Eulogius and Olivares were partly motivated by the need to defend the martyrs against ecclesiastical leaders who preferred to continue to live and to continue to live their lives of submission under Muslim rule in the interest of peace. Such unsympathetic views of the martyrs of Cordoba are echoed today in the relatively scholarly neglect of the Catholic sources and Christian sources on the Islamic conquest as testimonies of the Catholics' losses. That's all for today. On Breadbox Media, this is Chuck Coughlin, attempting in a humble way, in a small way, to set the record straight.